Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome everyone today participating in our sixth annual Nonprofit State of the Union 2025, Building a Future Ready Nonprofit. My name is Amy Boland, and I'm a partner and the audit director here at GRF. Today, I am joined by an all-star cast of GRF's audit, tax, accounting technology, and risk advisory experts. We also have a wonderful guest speaker joining us today. Carl Spanbauer, the controller at Capital Area Food Bank, has graciously offered his time to be with us. Thank you all for being here today. We have a lot of great information to share with you. First, there is 1.5 CPE credits available for today's event. Participants seeking CPE credit today must complete and submit a short survey that will appear automatically following the webinar. To obtain CPE, please participate in each of the polling questions throughout the session, as that will be how we gauge your active participation. Please note that this webinar is not intended as financial or legal advice. This is simply for educational purposes. We're GRF CPAs and Advisors based out of Bethesda, Maryland, serving clients in the DMV as well as nationally and internationally. Our firm serves a wide range of clients covering not-for-profit, for-profit, schools, government contractors, and others. However, our particular niche is within the not-for-profit INGO space. We've been in operation for several decades, and next year we'll be celebrating our 45th year anniversary. A couple announcements here before we get started with the content. I would like to congratulate our newest audit partners, John McIntosh and Christian Spencer. John has been with the firm for many years, and we're so excited to recognize his growth. Christian joins us with many years of nonprofit knowledge and experience. We're so lucky to welcome him here at GRF. Congratulations to both of you. As you can see here, we have a lot of exciting content to cover today, but I would be remiss if I didn't at least mention the recent events that are affecting many of you. Many of you have been reaching out with respect to the executive order on reevaluating and realigning United States foreign aid. Many of you received notice of suspension letters. And now, as of this morning, with the temporary pause on federal grants and loans, a lot have been reaching out as well. We currently have a team that is monitoring the situation. We will keep you informed as we know more. There is a lot of uncertainty at this time, but we feel we are stronger together as a community. GRF works with over 850 nonprofits, and we are developing an idea to gather a working group or roundtable to meet on a regular basis to share thoughts about the recent events. We have added a question in the survey at the end of the webinar to gauge if this would be of interest to you. However, let's move on to today's webinar. I will now pass things over to Christian, who will provide a 2025 outlook for nonprofits and associations.
Great. Well, very good morning to everyone, and very nice to be with you this morning. I think if we take a step back and look at 2025, two key themes come to mind as we think about 2025. One, as Amy mentioned before, the recent events with the executive actions really kind of drive home the concept of expect the unexpected. 1 month into the new year, and a lot of what we're going to talk about today for the first few minutes is going to be how you can position your organization and sort of pivot when the unexpected occurs and be ready, in advance for that. And I think the second tier to this is really thinking about your key fundamental pillars as an organization that, regardless of what's happening in the current events, Those pillars don't really change. And I think that's what we're going to drive home here in the latter part of this, first section, about sticking by your pillars, about staying focused on what you do as an organization. So really, in order to kind of move ahead to 2025, we kind of need to close the chapter with 2024. In the first couple of bullets here, talk about the really double-digit growth that the financial markets performed and experienced during 2024, with the S&P up 23%, the NASDAQ up 29%. As a result, consumer spending increased in 2024, really driven by rising incomes and wages, and by and large, a very strong job market. So those are the positives from 2024. But when we think about, one of the negatives, it really was the fly in the ointment, which continues to be inflation. And inflation is not really where it needs or is projected to be at this point. So as a result, as you can see here in the third bullet, in terms of charitable giving, although it was up 2%, according to Giving USA, when adjusted for inflation, it actually declined. So again, the inflationary pressures that we're seeing in the market really had a kind of overall negative impact when you look at the the purchasing power of the donated dollars. Again, looking at that inflation, it was at 2.9% versus a targeted rate of 2%, resulting in higher costs that I'm sure we've all experienced both at a nonprofit and corporate level, as well as at an individual level. Current prognostications show that that targeted 2% is really not expected to be hit in the current environment until 2026. So as a result of some of the positives being the consumer spending in the market, the Fed rates were not, the cuts were not as frequent or as large as anticipated. There were only three cuts, the vast majority of which occurred near the end of 2024. And looking ahead to 2025, the Fed is only projecting two rate cuts. So again, if you take a look at the results of 2024 and you kind of parlay that into what has 2025 looked, it's going to be a sort of a mixed bag. And I think, as Amy mentioned before, some of the actions and some of the executive orders that have come out from the new administration leave us all really with one word, and that's uncertainty. But I would say, in terms of thinking about that uncertainty, when you take a look at the executive order that just came out in terms of the pause on funding, I would really encourage everyone to kind of take a look at that. It's a two-page document and read through it. You certainly can draw your own conclusions as to what the content says and as to what your interpretation of some of this is. But it's a fairly easy read. It's not a technical kind of legal document, but there are a number of items in there that I think are noteworthy, one of which is this pause is temporary in nature. Now, while that doesn't, I would say, immediately address cash flow needs of organizations that are looking for drawdowns and looking for grant activity to be consummated, keep in mind that it is temporary. It's certainly not final. Also, inside of the document, and again, I would encourage you to read through it, there are a number of sections that talk about legally mandated acts, or kind of to quote, extent required by the law. So that there are some potential outs in there. And again, I'm not an attorney. I don't practice law, don't pretend to, but I think that opens up some interpretation that you can work with your contracting officer, you can work with your external counsel to see if that gives you some sort of avenue ahead in terms of continued funding. And then it explicitly does state inside of the document that the OMB may grant exceptions in certain cases as well, on a case-by-case basis. So I think all of this kind of coupled with the fact that a lot of the mumble chatter is around these funds and these grant funds are executive or congressionally approved and legislatively approved kind of mandates, or they're part of the budget. So there is some question about whether or not this action is even technically enforceable. So again, I know it's kind of creates a shock and awe, I think, when things like this come out, and I would argue that's probably the intended impact. But I would say take the time to read the document, consult with your brain trust in terms of your internally, as well as all of that as well. So take that in mind as with the current events. So again, I think as we move ahead in the slides and you take a look at what the 2025 outlook is, certainly the takeaway here is nobody can predict what's going to happen. Besides the recent current events, there's also been some proposed tariffs, and one of those tariffs was attempted to be enacted through Colombia this week, and that was ultimately pulled back. But again, I think you're going to see a lot of jockeying for position and a lot of things that are going to create an uncertain environment. But I would say that there's, in spite of all this, as I mentioned at the onset of the presentation, there's certain pillars that remain steadfast for any organization, really regardless of what the current events are. And that's what we want to drive home here, is that it's not all doom and gloom, that these are really opportunities to continue, as you can see here in the first bullet, have that donor engagement now more than ever, demonstrate that value proposition to your members, if you're a membership-based organization, to your donors, if you're a donor-driven organization, and keep them engaged, whether this is through kind of a wide net, through virtual or hybrid events, or through in-person events as well, and continue to have that connectivity with those that help you execute and drive your mission financially. Second bullet talks about strategic risks and opportunities. And again, always looking at what, as an organization, are you seeing on the near, short-term, and long-term horizon in terms of risks impacting your organization and opportunities to continue to provide that value proposition to your constituents. And aligning, first and foremost, making sure you have financial reserves or have a reserve policy, but then aligning those reserves with these risks and opportunities. Really, in terms of a short-term reserve for events like we're kind of currently experiencing right now, in terms of a cash need, and then long-term reserves as well. As we move to the next slide, again, artificial intelligence is out there, and we have an entire presentation on that that we'll be talking about shortly. I would also say investing in your staff and training. Again, that the staff and your the backbone of your organization or what enables you to execute your mission. There's going to be a lot of baby boomers retiring. There needs to be a lot of succession planning and key positions and thinking about that moving ahead. And then finally, really looking in the aggregate at nonprofit organizations. We as a collective entity, as a collective trust, account for about 10% of non-governmental workforce, and really play, as we all know, an instrumental role in our socioeconomic environment. So, continue to remain steadfast in your pillars, addressing your risks, but also, being ready and able to pivot on a moment's notice, should events dictate the need to. So I think we have our first polling question here, just to make sure we're able to award that CPE as a requirement. So please go ahead and hopefully answer in the affirmative. And I will now pass it along to my colleague, John McIntosh, to talk a little bit about the uniform guidance.
Thanks, Christian. Good morning, everyone. My topic this morning is really the 2024 revisions to the uniform guidance. And as Christian has already touched on, there's really been a lot of developments in this federal funding space just in the last couple of days, and things are moving quickly and there's lots of uncertainty. But I think that both Amy and Christian really set the stage perfectly. This pause, for now at least, is just temporary. There's opportunities for waivers and lots of challenges already to if it's even legally permissible. But with all that being said, at this point in time, there's no real impact on the uniform guidance itself. The guidance still stands, and there are no changes to the related audit requirements. So we want to, go over what the new changes were last year. And, many of you work for nonprofit organizations that receive grants and awards from the U.S. federal government. But for those of you who don't, the uniform guidance is really that government-wide framework for grants management, and it outlines all the strict compliance requirements that federal award recipients need to follow. And the goal of the guidance is really to standardize how non-federal entities manage their awards and keep things efficient, transparent, and accountable. And you can always access the guidance for free at ecfr.gov. This is always the most up-to-date version of the guidance and is available to anyone at any time. So what really changed last year? So back on April 4th of 2024, the OMB issued the revised guidance for federal financial assistance. And this was really considered by many to be the biggest update to the guidance since its original release in 2014. And they issued a pre-publication version that you can find at cfo.gov or just Googling the revisions. And this pre-publication version has a red line version that shows the old CFR to the changes. And the key goals of the revisions were, at least up until today, to increase access to funding and improve oversight and accountability. Now, what's really important is to understand what the effective dates of their revisions are. And the effective date was really on October 1, 2024, so really just a couple of months ago. But there are some key nuances to the effective date that everyone needs to be aware of. It is specifically for new awards that are issued on or after the effective date. If you have any pre-existing awards, they would require a modification from the donor for the awards to be applicable. So one thing that we're really recommending to any of our single audit clients is when you're preparing your CEFA is to add another column onto that that indicates if each award is or is not applicable to the new guidance as different audit requirements will apply depending on its applicability. So there's a lot of notable revisions with these changes. For the sake of time, we're going to just touch on some of the highlights here. When it comes to equipment, they have increased both the definitional and disposable reporting requirements for equipment and supplies from $5,000 to $10,000. They've also added some distinctions between equipment and supplies. Equipment, the threshold applies to the per unit current fair market value, where supplies, it's based on the total value of the supplies now, which is really to avoid stockpiling at the end of any period of performance. Updates to the definition of total modified direct cost, really specifically related to subaward exclusions and applying an indirect rate to those. They've increased that threshold from $25,000 to $50,000 for each subaward. So theoretically, you're able to recapture more indirect costs on each individual subaward. Sticking with indirect costs, some of the biggest changes by far fall under the indirect cost section. One of these is related to the de minimis rate, which they have increased from 10% to up to 15%. They also stated that if you're currently using a NICRA, you cannot switch to the de minimis rate while under a NICRA. And then for those that do use NICRAs, they have clarified that all federal agencies and pass-through entities must accept their direct recipients' NICRA rates. And now regarding pre-approvals of certain costs, the old guidance had about 70-something items that required pre-written approval, and the new guidance has removed 9 of those items, including the use of grant agreements, real property, equipment, certain entertainment costs, membership costs, selling and marketing costs. But it's important to note that even though there's no immediate written approval needed for some of these costs, they still must have a programmatic project purpose and be included in the initial budget. Now, when it comes to single audit requirements, one of the biggest changes here is that they have increased the single audit and type A major program threshold from $750,000 to $1 million. But a really important thing to know about the audit requirements is what the effective date is. So earlier we talked about how the effective date of the revisions was October 1, 2024. Since audits run on fiscal years and not as of certain points in time, all of the audit revisions are effective for your fiscal years beginning after October 1, 2024. So if you have a December 31st fiscal year end, these changes will not apply to your 2024 audit, but they will be effective for your 2025 audit. Now, I think the key takeaway is that there's lots of changes here, and the GRF, we're always here to help you. And we've developed a Federal Financial Assistance Resource Center on our website that is free for anyone to use. You can access it by going to the GRF website and under the resources link, which I've got circled here, the bottom right option is for that new resource center. And on our next slide here, I've got a screenshot of what at least the top of the resource center looks like. And there's lots of great information here. We have some pre-recorded webinars that go much more in depth on all the items I've been covering. There are some written articles summarizing the changes if you don't have time to watch a whole hour long webinar. There's some great blog posts on the cybersecurity considerations of the new revisions. And then really our best part here is thanks to our great marketing team, we've developed this printable checklist on how your organization can be prepared for the changes. I've circled the link here for the checklist, and it's got lots of information on how to update your policies. And then the Resource Center also includes a little bit below this, a list of individuals at GRF that are kind of experts in this space and their contact information that, you know, we're always here to help you if you have any questions. So feel free to contact any one of us at any time if needed. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Alejandra. Or no, sorry, the next polling question. Another pulse check to see if everyone's still with us. Leave that one open for another couple seconds before we turn it over.
All right. So thank you, John, and thank you everyone for attending today's webinar. I will be talking about leveraging AI and data analytics in the audit. So talking a little bit more about some of the things that we're doing behind the scenes here at GRF. Before I get into it, I wanted to show this chart here that is forecasting the use of AI adoption by function for 2025. So if you look down at the finance line, you can see that the dark red and the black means that either AI has been adopted widespread throughout the organization and through the finance function, as well as you know, that it's now become a critical part of the finance function. So again, something that it's not going away. If anything, it seems like AI is here to stay. And so it's really important that we all embrace that. And at GRF, we have, you know, that mentality of being future focused, not staying behind the curve, but being ahead of the curve. So as part of being on the tech committee here on the audit side, along with three other audit partners, we're constantly looking at new technology, demoing new platforms and systems that we could use to make our audits a little bit more efficient. And so one of the things that I want to talk today about is Trulian. So Trulian is something that we demoed a little over a year ago and have implemented slowly throughout you know, the audit department. And what it is, it's an AI platform that helps reduce manual tasks for audit teams. So there's various capabilities within Trulian. And I will say we're not using it on every single engagement. So we are, you know, piloting the software and the platform throughout. So you can definitely let us know if you're interested in us using those. We're still working out some kinks here and there, but for the most part, we've really started to see some major efficiencies with the software and the platform. So one of the things that it does is data match, which builds simple logic. For example, if we're testing 40 disbursements, we want to be able to trace those samples to invoices, contracts, bank statements. What the data match does is it matches. We are able to build logic to be able to vouch to those source documents pretty easily. Then we have the financial statement suite or validation. So that takes a look to make sure that the financial statements are footed. It also takes a look at, you know, current year versus prior year financial statements and make sure that all of the prior year numbers, you know, line up with the finalized reports from the prior year. So again, a time savings in that respect. And then we have data extract, which I think is pretty cool. What it does is that pulls key data from PDFs of invoices, lease agreements, you know, contracts and leases. Oh, you okay? So it looks like my sound is not working so well. So let me see what I can do. I'm not really sure. I'm using my headphones. Okay, looks like some can hear me fine. Okay, great. I will continue. Then we have Truly, which is a Gen AI chatbot. So think of it like ChatGPT on steroids. So it's a really useful tool, and I'll be able to show you what that looks like in a few moments. Here's the data match example. So I wanted to give you guys a visual of what that looks like. So here on the left-hand side, you'll see our samples and that it's matching certain metrics within our sample to the source document. For example, the invoice date, the PO number, the amounts, all of those are being matched. And so what it does pretty quickly, it's able to validate that information. And if there's any discrepancies, it'll flag it for us and we can investigate further. And then we have data extract. I find this really useful when we're looking at lease agreements. Lease agreements can be 100 pages long, a lot of terms and conditions and so forth within the agreements. And so the data extract allows you to say, okay, I need to extract, for example, the payment schedule on that lease. And so here you can see that example. And last but not least, my favorite is Truly. So Truly has been an amazing tool. Here, what I did was I fed it Apple's 10K from 2024, and then I asked it to identify or flag any significant fluctuations. And within a few minutes, it highlighted those key areas. And so here you can see, for example, on the operating expenses, selling G&A costs went up $1.2 billion from year to year. Whoa, big fluctuation there. And it says here it reflects higher operational costs. So then it allows us as the auditors to quickly flag and then investigate further and do further inquiry with our clients. And then as far as data analytics, we have been using data analytics in our audits for as long as I can remember. So some of the things I'm not gonna go through every bullet point, but the comparative analysis is pretty important. And I think it's important here that we benchmark against similar organizations. We do work with over 850 nonprofits. So being able to benchmark against similar sized organizations and see where you fall within that, I think is very key. We also use data analytics to help us select our samples, gives us more representative sample versus judgmentally selecting those samples. And then I'm going to end it with AI gone rogue. So again, AI should be the start, not the end result. So while we are using these tools and piloting different tools that are available, it is always the start. We're still using our judgment and looking to make sure that the information that we are being given is accurate and so forth. So with that, I am going to head on to polling question number three. So if you're still listening, go ahead and answer the polling question before we head into the next section.
Okay, thank you, Alejandra. My name is Caitlin Miller, and I'm joined today with Lisa Heller. Lisa and I have a number of important tax updates that we'll be sharing with you today. I'll kick it off with some helpful reminders and updates, and then Lisa will follow with anticipated nonprofit tax developments in this new administration. Okay, so first, some state compliance reminders. State charity regulators continue to enforce compliance with charitable solicitation laws. Nonprofits soliciting public donations must adhere to registration and filing requirements. Some online platforms are now using new technology to scan a nonprofit's compliance with state registration and filing requirements, and in some cases, even suspending the charity's ability to raise funds through their platform if they're delinquent on their filings. So it's important to stay ahead of this. We're planning a future webinar on this topic for organizations to gain more detailed information to remain compliant, so stay tuned. DC exemption renewals. As a reminder, exempt organizations are required to register with the DC Office of Tax and Revenue every 5 years to receive tax exemption. The DC OTR will provide a notice to taxpayers 180 days prior to expiration. If no action is taken, taxpayers will receive a second notice 30 days prior to expiration. Organizations can proactively renew their exemptions online at mytax.dc.gov. So we recommend you log into your portal to stay on top of your exemption certificates. FinCEN BOI reports. So now for an update on the Corporate Transparency Act's Beneficial Ownership Information Reporting Requirement. You may have heard about the newly effective BOI reporting rules that were put in place by the CTA. The CTA was designed to create a corporate database at the FinCEN that can be used to target tax evasion, terrorists, money laundering, and other criminal activities often carried out through shell companies. Importantly, most nonprofit organizations are exempt from the reporting rules, which makes sense because most nonprofit organizations do not have owners. The CTA includes a list of 33 types of entities that are exempt from the beneficial ownership reporting, including Section 501C exempt organizations, 527 political organizations, 4947A charitable trusts, and certain wholly owned subsidiaries of the nonprofits listed above. There is some uncertainty about entities who have yet to apply for exempt status or whose application is pending. But entities requiring to file existing before 24 were initially instructed to file by January 1st of this year. But in December of 24, a judge halted the reporting requirement. It was then reinstated and then halted again, at least for now. So as of January 23rd of this year, a BOI injunction remains in place. The case will return to court in March, so stay tuned for now. But nonprofits continue to be exempt from this requirement. Elective pay for clean energy tax credits. One of the key updates in the IRA is the ability for tax-exempt entities to elect to receive certain tax credits as direct payments. The elective pay option allows eligible non-taxable entities to treat the credits as refundable credits. This means that instead of reducing a tax liability, which most of these entities do not have, they receive a direct payment from the IRS for full value of the credits that they may generate. As a reminder, we've partnered with TriMerit, who helps our clients compute these credits if you believe you might be eligible. And then lastly, IRS direct pay. IRS is now allowing businesses, including exempt orgs, to make certain payments using their direct pay system. It's a simpler alternative to EFTPS, which requires registering and waiting for a PIN to arrive by snail mail, periodic logins to keep their account active. So now businesses can pay their tax liabilities directly from their bank account without the hassle of setting up an EFTPS account. The same option has been available for individuals for years, but this is new for EOs. Payment types currently being accepted through direct pay include 990T, 990PF, and 1120, possibly 1120POL is included here, similar to EFTPS. Payment types that are not on this list include 4720 and then 990T and PF extension payments, although perhaps those could be lumped in with balance due on return payments for those noted above. This new development provides another option, potentially easier than EFTPS, for our clients to get their taxes paid, which is great news. That's all for me. I will turn it over to Lisa now.
Thanks, Caitlin. Hi, everyone. I'm Lisa Heller, and I'll be giving a brief overview of anticipated tax developments for nonprofits. We'll just move the slide over. It's day 9 of the new administration, everyone, and I admit I've been making some last-minute adjustments to my outline so I can try to give you the latest. Over the last week, there's been a flurry of executive orders and governmental instructions that would impact nonprofits. Some of them won't take effect immediately, and many are being challenged or may otherwise be unenforceable. I'll just be taking a few minutes to talk about specific tax-related changes that could impact the nonprofit sector. The first is the nomination of Billy Long for IRS commissioner. It's notable because Commissioner Daniel Werfel stepped down on Inauguration Day 3 years before his term was set to end. Commissioners have traditionally been allowed to complete 5-year terms, regardless of changes in the White House. Long is also not your typical commissioner nominee. He's a former congressman and auctioneer by trade with limited tax experience. So it'll be interesting to see what this move means in terms of influencing tax policy and IRS operations. The second is a hiring freeze on unfilled positions in the federal government. Hiring freezes are not new at the start of new administrations, but this one is different because, unlike for other agencies, the hiring freeze for IRS is indefinite until it's deemed in the national interest to lift it, whatever that means. We've heard reports of IRS rescinding job offers too, including to seasonal workers for the 2025 filing season. There's also been an order for an end to remote work arrangements for federal employees. I suspect that this remote work directive will get some IRS employees to resign or retire, and they won't be replaced anytime soon. Back in 2022, IRS was allocated $80 billion or so to improve staffing and update IT functions, and boy, do they need it. $40 billion of that has since been clawed back, so now they only have half their original allocation. I can only imagine that these changes will lead to more processing and customer service delays at IRS. We shall see what the future holds. While there's been a lot of speculation about coming changes to the tax laws themselves, that's all there is right now, speculation. And yet there's been another new directive blocking agencies from issuing new regulations and instructing them to consider a 60-day hold on any regs that have been issued but haven't yet taken effect. This limitation applies to tax regs too, but we in the tax world are used to waiting a long time for IRS and Treasury to issue tax regulations. So now getting to my bullet points, the priority guidance plan is issued each year, and it lists the priority projects for allocating IRS and Treasury resources for that year. This most recent plan letter includes 231 items in total, including 10 items on seven different matters for exempt organizations. Most of these are repeats from previous years, as each project does take a long time to complete. We'll focus on three big ones, starting with donor-advised funds, or DAFs. A first set of proposed DAF regulations were issued in November 2023, 17 years after they were first established in the code. So that's a long time there and still waiting. These proposed regulations offered clear but broad definitions of a DAF, a donor advisor, advisory privileges, and taxable distributions. Literally hundreds of comments came in on these proposed regs, so many so that the initial comment period was extended. We've been told that IRS and Treasury read and consider every comment they receive on proposed regs, so we appreciate that consideration, but it adds even more time to their process. Meanwhile, we're waiting on more regs and guidance on DAFs, including how private foundations may work with DAFs, whether using DAFs to fulfill donor pledges give more than an incidental benefit to the donor, how to include DAF payments in a recipient's public support test, and whether DAFs will be subject to minimum payout requirements like private foundations are. Lots more to come on DAFs, and we've been waiting very patiently. For group exemptions, IRS issued Notice 2020-36 in May 2020, and that proposed substantial changes to group exemption procedures pending future guidance. At that time, they pretty much stopped processing and administration of group exemptions, including not accepting any new group exemption requests. So group exemption administration has been at a standstill for almost 5 years now. Practitioners and central organizations are really hoping for that updated guidance sooner rather than later, so we'll see. We're also patiently waiting on regs on how to allocate expenses and net operating losses incurred across unrelated business income silos. Of course, we'll abbreviate unrelated business income to UBI. The expense allocation matter has been out there since 2017 with the introduction of Section 512A6 creating UBI silos. The 2017 tax law also eliminated a carryback period for net operating losses incurred after 2017, but the CARES Act temporarily brought them back as part of that COVID tax relief package. Absent regulations, and I'm not giving tax advice here, but please just document your methods for allocating these items across UBI silos. It's always a good idea to document your tax positions taken. Let's see if this works. All right. I also wanted to mention a few bits of legislation proposed during 2024. These are not so much predictions of things to come as they are a list of items we've seen the sector take an interest in, and these are listed in no particular order. In the last year or so, we've seen a lot of attention paid to higher ed, colleges, and universities. Most relevant for this discussion are several proposed modifications to the Section 4968 excise tax on private college and university endowments. We've heard that maybe 40 schools have reported and paid this tax in recent years, and the tax paid in any given year has been approximately $70 million. Some of the proposed modifications have been to lower the threshold of non-charitable use assets from $500,000 to $250,000 per student, student to include only U.S. citizens and permanent residents in the asset per student calculation and to increase the tax rate from 1.4% to as high as 20%. The idea here is to broaden the base and increase tax revenue from higher ed to help pay for other tax cuts somewhere else. And now for something completely different. There's been proposed legislation to require gain recognition on the transfer of appreciated property to non-charitable exempts like 501c4, c5, c6, and 527 organizations. This change would close a potential loophole in the current tax code. We haven't seen any proposals on taxing transfers of appreciated property to C3 entities. There would still be no gain recognition in most cases there. By the way, that's one of the oldest tax planning tools out there. It's pretty much as old as the Internal Revenue Code itself. And again, this is not tax advice, but you can still donate appreciated property to a charity, not pay capital gains tax on the appreciation, and get a deduction for the fair market value in many cases at the time of the donation if you itemize. One measure that's likely to be taken up in this new Congress is H.R. 9495, which would give the Secretary of the Treasury broad power to revoke the exempt status of organizations that conduct or support terrorist activities. This legislation aims to prevent the misuse of exempt status for funding or promoting terrorism. One big question is how broadly the term terrorism is defined for this purpose. Some organizations are concerned that possible expanded authority to challenge exempt status would encourage self-censorship and try to restrict the activities of certain organizations or otherwise make them vulnerable. Remember, it's already illegal to aid terrorists and their supporters, and that already can result in the loss of tax-exempt status. Let's just see what happens, and we'll keep you posted on this one as things develop. There's a proposal to update Schedule F of Form 990 to report recipients of foreign grants in more detail and also require Form 990 reporting of contributions received from foreign nationals. These proposals are intended to increase transparency and accountability surrounding foreign grant activities. And finally, per this list, there's been some legislation to reintroduce a special above-the-line charitable contributions deduction for individual taxpayers who don't itemize. In past years, that was $300 for individuals and $600 for joint filers. Charities are very much in favor of bringing back this little tax perk, as it would create additional incentive for individuals to contribute to deserving charities. That's what I have for today. Caitlin and I thank you for your time and attention. And now on to top risks for 2025.
All right. Thank you so much and great job, as always. So I just wanted to highlight that every year around this time, we put out our top risk report. So we basically get out our little crystal ball. Oh, and by the way, I'm Melissa Musser, Partner and Director of Risk and Advisory Services. So basically, we get out our little crystal ball and we look to see what would be impacting our clients. And part of that is our risk advisory team takes all the different risk reports. A lot of them are issued in the fall. We basically synthesize all of those and we compile them into our top risk report. And you'll find all those different reports listed in the appendix. So it's kind of like your one-stop place to look. All things risk related, but we will synthesize that into what it means for our clients. So basically, we've broke it down to three themes this year. Now, this top theme, legislation and policy change, specifically as it relates to impact on funding, tax exempt status, tax liabilities, this is at the top of our list for many reasons. And Lisa and Caitlin just really highlighted a lot of that. But this is a fast moving risk with a lot of uncertainty around the extent of the changes. So we're monitoring the developments. We suggest you do the same as well. We suggest you do some scenario planning so that you're prepared for the various outcomes. Enterprise risk management can definitely help you formalize this process, along with aligning communications across your organization, as well as handling plans. I'm going to put in the chat some ERM resources. We also do ERM events. But this is a great resource for you, really for any of these top risks, but it can really help you narrow them down and come up with really good handling plans. I would also notice under this legislation and policy change, it's a good time to revisit your strategic plan and make sure it aligns with your tax exempt mission and complies with the laws to protect your status. I know we've gotten a lot of emails and concerns around this area. So just you want to make sure that your activities remain consistent and that you have a whistleblower plan in place, a program in place, so that if you can quickly be alerted to issues, and if there are rogue actors within your organization, you can respond to that quickly and timely. Now, next on the list is cybersecurity. These are really in any order because cybersecurity could be your number one risk. We're seeing this is the number one risk across the board, really across the world. It's kind of a perennial risk. We're not really expecting this to go anywhere as it's really kind of tightly aligned with digital transformation, artificial intelligence. So many of these risks are interrelated. That's why we're really kind of calling these themes. This is a top risk theme. I don't have a lot of time to get into this today, but there are three things I wanted to just kind of note. One is that cybersecurity is probably a top risk within your organization. And if so, I would expect to see discussion of that, of your risk and what you're doing about it in your minutes. Now, I don't know if it's going to be, you know, at the board level or if it's delegated to your audit committee. I would suggest you looking at your audit committee charter to see where this risk oversight responsibility lies. But either way, I'm going to expect to see some sort of discussion in your minutes. So make sure that you're getting the information you need and that you're having those conversations. Number two, you really need to have an information security policy. There's no reason not to have one. Even if you outsource IT to a third party, you still need to have an information security policy. And that actually needs to be updated every year. So every year you're supposed to do a risk assessment and every year you're supposed to update your policy accordingly. So we're really gonna be expecting to see that. I strongly suggest you do that. Please don't hesitate to reach out. We understand that you're a nonprofit, so reasonable cybersecurity, reasonable policies is what expected. I know it can get very complicated. We like to keep it simple, but please make sure that you have something and that folks are trained on it. And the last thing I wanted to highlight with cyber is that cybersecurity risk doesn't just sit with your chief technology officer, or maybe you outsource to a third party. They don't really own the risk. This is an enterprise-wide risk. And the other problem is that when you should be conducting audits, right? If this is the number one risk for you, you need to be conducting audits. And a lot of times what we see is maybe the chief technology officer is the one that engages someone to get the audit and is in control of what exactly the results are. And what should be happening is that this audit should be independent of the entire process. And that, for example, just like a financial statement audit is really executed, for example, by the board of directors and that information goes directly to them. That's exactly what should be happening with a cybersecurity audit. I'm a little distracted because the slides are kind of going all over the place here, But anyway, the biggest thing that I'm trying to highlight is that you need to be getting independent information on these cybersecurity audits. So for example, sometimes we'll have people say, well, our third-party service provider does an assessment. That's not the same thing as an audit. Folks that are not independent to the process cannot accurately assess themselves and tell you the true risks. I actually think this is one of the main reasons why this is such a big issue, is because we are not getting that independent information that we need to truly fix the problem. So I strongly urge you, and some of these cybersecurity audits do not have to be that expensive, but please get an independent assessment, look to get it done at least annually. And moving on to this last section under significant disruption, I don't think I have to convince any of you that we've seen a lot of natural disasters, lots of disruption. Significant operational disruption can be generated from a lot of different things. Obviously, natural disasters could be over-reliance on a third party. It could be an internal cybersecurity event. So the biggest thing is that you need to do is really assess your most significant risks. What are some of the top scenarios? Are you prepared? Do you have insurance coverage? I know that's top of mind. What are you relying on most? Is there a particular technology that could crash? Is there an individual that is going to leave, or if something happened to them, would there be a significant disruption? do you have a plan? All right, so what I would suggest you do is maybe identify maybe the top three scenarios. Make sure you have, and I hear it says BCPDR. This is a business continuity plan or disaster recovery plan. Make sure you have it documented. Make sure the people that need to be informed are informed, and really conduct exercises. You know, you should be doing this annually. If this is a significant risk to you, you should be doing this annually. So those are some of the three main themes and takeaways. So please do not hesitate to reach out to me. Find me on LinkedIn. I love talking about this stuff. I'm going to put in the chat some ERM resources as well as some ERM events that we'll be holding. And now I'm going to be turning it over to John and Heather to talk to us about technology, but I think we also have another polling question possibly. All right, guys, take it away.
All right, thanks, Melissa. We'll give it a couple seconds. All right, I think I'll just jump in. I know we're moving through a ton of content here this morning really quickly, so we really appreciate everyone for joining us today. Today, Heather and I are going to go explore the best accounting technology for nonprofits and how leveraging the right technologies can help nonprofits meet future demands. So jumping right in, nonprofits are increasingly embracing technology to streamline financial management, enhance transparency, and improve reporting and compliance. Nonprofits, and especially many of the clients that we work with in the outsourced accounting space, face several challenges, including tight budgets, talent shortages, complex reporting requirements, and the need for accurate data. I can tell you from personal experience that all of these factors are faced by the majority of clients that I worked with, and we see these factors week in, week out. So our session today aims to highlight some of the best of the accounting technologies that can help nonprofits optimize their operations, meet future demands, and drive long-term sustainability. For example, many of our clients use Sage Intacct so they can track projects using more than one reporting dimension and or because they have multiple entities. And that's just one example. And this allows them to harness the power of that software to kind of take the grunt work out of what used to be manual reporting in that example. So for our first pivot, I'm going to turn this over to Heather so that we can get started on some key trends in nonprofit accounting. So
thanks, John, and hello, everyone. I'd like to start off with sharing some of the key technology trends that we are seeing in nonprofit accounting today. From my perspective, the significant trends really include automation, cloud-based solutions, data-driven decision-making, of course, increased compliance requirements, and integration with other systems. We are really seeing more and more that automated processes, such as invoicing, expense tracking, are really revolutionizing our workflows. By replacing those manual tasks, we are significantly reducing human error and saving valuable time. Additionally, in today's data-driven world, analytic tools are becoming more and more essential. They enable us to make better financial forecasts, create accurate budgets, and allocate resources more efficiently. And as regulations continue to evolve, especially for grant-funded nonprofits, advanced technology solutions are becoming crucial. This leads us to what I feel are really the two most impactful trends: cloud-based accounting software and related integrations with other accounting and operating systems. The transition to cloud-based accounting software is not just a trend. It definitely is a permanent shift. So with that permanent shift to cloud-based accounting solutions, the key question for all nonprofit organizations is, what are the cloud-based accounting technologies for nonprofits? First, my primary recommendation, as John alluded to in the introduction, is Sage Intacct ERP. Sage Intacct is a leader in the nonprofit ERP space. It provides a scalable cloud-based financial management solution that is very tailored towards the growing needs of nonprofits. It is ideal for the medium to large nonprofit. It also offers advanced financial features like multi-entity management and real-time insights. This technology's flexibility, scalability, and real-time data access makes it indispensable for modern accounting. Some of what we've heard from our nonprofit clients that have deployed Sage Intacct is really that it's helped them increase efficiency by reducing painful manual data entry, accurately allocating expenses to grants, also reducing audit preparation time, and ultimately providing fast, real-time financial reports. All of these efficiencies have allowed them to better serve their communities and missions.
And now I'd like to turn it back over to John so he can spend a few minutes discussing top software in the cloud-based budgeting space that integrates seamlessly with Sage Intacct.
Thanks, Heather. Yeah, and one of the solutions that we like quite a bit and we want to talk about is Martis Solutions. Basically, it's a powerful budgeting and planning tool that allows an organization to build a budget from the ground up or take a simpler top-down approach. So as Heather mentioned, it seamlessly integrates over with Sage Intacct, and it's best for nonprofits kind of moving away from Excel. And the main reasons that nonprofits move away from Excel in this scenario is kind of due to like version control issues and user management issues. And so I'll talk a little bit more about that with a more in-depth use case here. And so think about an organization that has more than just a basic budgeting process. So if you're a nonprofit and you're doing a more basic top-down budgeting, so you kind of already have an idea where you're going to go, you know what your revenue is, and you can kind of back into it from there, I think Excel works perfectly fine in that case. So you're not going to need a fancy budget tool in most situations for that. What we're trying to solve for here is when you're trying to build a budget from the ground up with multiple parties involved. And so what do I mean by that? A typical scenario where you have multiple people running programs or departments, and you also have people running internal operations. And so once that number of folks starts to get above a couple of people, you start dealing with more complex Excel spreadsheets, or my least favorite, some type of web-based Google Sheet or something like that. And you start to run into things like formula errors, version control, and overall technical errors. So an example of a technical error there that Martis solves for is the payroll side. And the name, seeing that chat, the name of the solution that we like is Martis Solutions. So, but let me give you an example. If you're building out a payroll budget, Martis allows you to build that from the ground up with all of the backend stuff in there automated. So we've seen clients, make mistakes with payroll tax calculations, other benefit calculations. And so with a solution like Martis, you don't have those type of issues. So that's just one of the use case scenarios for Martis. And one of the things I like, frankly, is that when you have a large team involved in a budgeting process, that team is doing that in Martis. They're not doing it in Sage Intacct. So it keeps the budget team, it keeps the program team out of Sage Intacct and where they need to be, which is, in my view, in Martis. So Heather, I was just curious, what about other recommendations you have to share kind of regarding technology that our clients might be able to leverage that integrates with Sage Intacct?
Thanks, John. Absolutely, I'm happy to share. So I think my first comment there would be the goal here is to really create a comprehensive cloud-based technology suite. Sage Intacct, Martis Solution, and all other accounting technologies really can seamlessly integrate with various other nonprofit operation solutions, such as fundraising, donor management, payroll, HR, and project tracking systems. For example, systems like Sage Intacct integrate with fundraising platforms such as DonorPerfect and Flux for grant management. This allows for seamless financial tracking of donations and grants in real time. And technologies such as ADP and Paychex, they integrate with Sage Intacct and other cloud-based financial management softwares to streamline payroll, HR activities, and ensure tax compliance. John, would you like to share your thoughts on what the benefits of leveraging the right accounting technology solutions are?
Absolutely. So leveraging the right accounting technology offers several benefits. And, you know, as I was preparing for this presentation, all of the points that we're about to go over, we see it day in, day out. And they're just critical for our clients as we seek to kind of do more every day with seemingly fewer resources and less time. And I think most of us on this call can kind of relate to that. And on a related note, the very first thing is time savings. You know, we're looking to automate as much as we can. And yes, absolutely, we're looking for increased analysis and insight into the numbers. But really, you know, another key benefit is overall efficiency of the accounting function and the finance function. And, you know, when we look to work with clients and when we're working with clients, I use the term low-hanging fruit when seeking to kind of identify the top priority of technology that we can identify to start saving our clients time and to start in making enhancements to the accounting function. And we typically start in the areas of accounts payable, expense reports, timekeeping, and cost allocation. And so basically what it comes down to is that efficient use of technology is really a key value proposition for us and for our clients. Accuracy, automating the data entry and the real-time updates that can be available significantly reduce the risk of errors. This one's a little bit self-explanatory, but it's really true in our experience. And it's really helped cut down errors and adjusting journal entries. Transparency and reporting. Modern accounting tools provide comprehensive and customizable reports to meet donor and stakeholder demands. Reporting and the extra dimensions available are one of the biggest reasons our clients move to Sage Intacct over something like QBO. So if you have ever been in a situation where you're using the class or a feature like that in QuickBooks and you find yourself exporting that data and having to do further manipulation in order to try to meet your demands for your funders, you know the pain that we are trying to help you solve for. Another key component of good technology tools is scalability. Cloud-based accounting systems, if you get the right ones, can easily scale to accommodate increasing volumes and complexity. So, you know, a good case study for you is, you know, we have a bunch of clients that scale up and down with the election cycle. So last year, we had one client go from 20 to literally 500 employees. So with the use of Sage Intacct and something called Data Blend, we were able to streamline that payroll journal entry. And instead of, you know, that shift from 20 to 500 employees being a monstrous undertaking, it ended up being a relatively simple workflow enhancement on our side. And, you know, and so that worked really well. And then the last thing I'd say before we wrap up our part here is that, of course, the main reasoning for accounting and financial data is that financial insight. In addition to, of course, wanting to have clean audits and be a good steward of financial resources, good cloud-based technology provides data analytics, allow you to make informed decisions, forecast your future needs, and evaluate your program efficiency, effectively allowing you to run your organization so that you can best meet your goals. So Heather and I would love to would like to thank you for your time today. But in conclusion, nonprofits that leverage the right accounting technology will not only meet the demands of today, but position themselves for long-term success in an ever-changing environment. And as we can see, the events of this week and the last week, we're seeing that the need to be flexible is going to be consistent. So regularly evaluating new technologies and trends ensures that your nonprofit is using the best tools available, allows you to make data-driven decisions that align financial strategy with the broader missions and goals of your nonprofit. So thank you very much. And we probably have one more polling question, I think. Here we go. And as that polling question wraps up, we're going to bring it back over to Alejandra.
Thank you, John. And thank you, everyone. I am back. It looks like the polling question disappeared, so I'm not sure if somebody from marketing can pop that up one last time. All right, so are you still listening? While that's up, I will go ahead and start our introduction to our guest today for the Fireside Chat. It is Carl Spanbauer, and Carl joined the Capital Area Food Bank in August 2022. As controller, Carl directs the accounting, audit, and grant administration functions at CAFB. He also oversees the robotic process automation and AI automatic solutions utilized by CAFB's finance department. He graduated from Brigham Young University with a bachelor's degree in accountancy. He started his career as an auditor in public accounting, where he served solely not-for-profit clients in the Washington, D.C. metro area. Early in his career, Carl developed a strong interest in the role of technology and data in the field of accounting. Since joining the food bank, he and his team have led the implementation of six key financial systems, revamped utilization of the organization's ERP system, and automated hundreds of manual processes. Carl is a licensed CPA in Maryland and Virginia. He is also published in the Journal of Accountancy and has presented at numerous industry conferences on his automation work at the food bank. So welcome, Carl, and thank you for being on with us today.
Thank you so much.
All right, so we have a couple of questions that we've prepared today. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about successful digital transformation and any other technology and initiatives that you've led in the finance department and the outcomes that they've delivered. And then just to back that up also, how were you able to get buy-in from everybody?
Yeah, happy to talk on this. So I think there's a broad range of topics you can talk about here. But of course, if you know me, I get really excited about things like robotic process automation, RPA, and AI. So over the past couple of years, I have implemented RPA and AI extensively throughout my accounting department. This has really helped us to automate literally hundreds of manual processes. My team affectionately calls my automations bots, if you will. So I'm going to refer to my automations as bots. You know, I could honestly talk for hours on this, but briefly, some example of the bots we have in place include things like automation of contribution revenue recognition and review of that revenue, processing snail mail, workflow delegation, making our systems just talk to each other better, preparing audit documentation. And of course, since we have federal grants, things like our vendor suspension and debarment search and employee level of effort confirmations. I generally estimate the value provided by all these bots is probably about one full-time employee. They save me and my team so much time every single day. I would honestly encourage any accountant to try to learn these technologies. I specifically use the Microsoft Power Platform. It's an RPA kind of digital transformation platform that's kind of built into Microsoft, but you know, there's also other platforms out there. The second part of your question, you know, while all this automation is great and we've had a lot of benefits, you know, it is super important you get buy-in from key stakeholders. Otherwise, things probably aren't going to go well if you try to implement RPA and AI. For example, very early on when I was still learning and tinkering with this stuff, I made a bot which hooked into Salesforce, which is our CRM software that we use. And the basic functionality was when, you know, when a major donation was entered into Salesforce, the bot would send the relevant development team member an email kind of just reminding them, please upload documentation to Salesforce because our auditors need to see that kind of stuff. So the email came from my email, so it looked like I emailed them, and the timing was instant. So the second they added a donation in Salesforce, they get an email in the next 30 seconds. One development team member said it felt like I designed a Big Brother system in Salesforce. I was constantly watching them at all times. So I kind of had to redesign the bot to be kind of more user-friendly. Instead, it now sends weekly consolidated updates. But instead, if I had, you know, kind of taken my time, talked to development, who's kind of the key stakeholder there, I think that bot rollout would have been a little more smoother. Next, I'd say the next big interested party is probably my team, my accounting team, including my boss, the CFO. Honestly, they're the easiest buy-in. The deal kind of is, you know, I develop these bots, which makes their day-to-day easier and less mundane. So for example, one of my bots saves my senior accountant about 20 hours a month. What it does is it makes revenue journal entries for her to upload into our ERP NetSuite. So that's an easy sell and buy-in from her. My boss, the CFO, loves to see the time savings and improve accuracy and timeliness of our financial close. So that's also another easy buy-in. Where it gets a bit more difficult is bringing in kind of the outside stakeholders. Specifically in my case, it'd be our IT department. Luckily, my IT director is a super cool guy and he likes to experiment and tinker with technology like I do. So he's kind of giving me a lot of kind of higher level access to these tools. You know, that being said, I am very adamant that my IT department understands everything I'm doing and kind of has the master key, if you will, to turn things off if needed. And honestly, ensuring smooth collaboration with my IT department has been key to success of all of our bots. We have a smooth and well-defined development, kind of testing, production lifecycle process for all the automations we use, which has been a huge help in leading to the success of all the RPA we use. So yeah, that's a little bit about the RPA AI initiative we've been working on these past couple of years.
Wow, just hearing the amount of time savings and everything that you've been able to accomplish, I think it just speaks
speaks great. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, that it's, you know, equivalent, that the fact that it's equivalent to what you're estimating one full-time employee is huge. I mean, because just think about the salary costs for that. Great information there. And if you have further questions, please feel free to drop it in the chat. We will have some time left over for questions. What else? What skills or competencies do you think finance professionals need to be future ready? And how are you ensuring that your team stays up to date?
This is a good question. As a prenote to my answer, I think it's important not to get overwhelmed with all of the new technology emerging. Because I know I definitely sometimes do. You know, I feel like there's 10,000 new tools that have fancy AI features, and it's easy to feel like you're kind of behind. My advice there, and something I follow, is like, you know, don't feel discouraged. Just have a mindset of continuous learning, which, much like any area in your life, and you know, I think you're going to be fine as we plunge into this world of AI. As for specific competencies, I will always push that every accountant at a baseline needs to be proficient in Excel. I'm not saying that you need to know every single function, but accountants do need to be comfortable with solving a wide variety of kind of data-driven problems using Excel. You know, whatever formula you use, you know, it's kind of up to you, but you do need to be comfortable kind of understanding this software. Once you have a strong base of Excel, you know, it's kind of easy to move on to the more advanced data analysis tools. But again, that Excel is kind of the base knowledge for learning kind of data structures and how all that stuff works. I'd also say learning basic programming will help you immensely. So my accounting degree program at Brigham Young University, I graduated almost a decade ago, makes me feel a little bit old, makes programming a mandatory part of the accounting degree, which actually turned out to be much more valuable to me than my accounting knowledge in my career. So, you know, you absolutely do not need to be a software engineer for programming knowledge to be useful. I like to think of programming as kind of like an excellent framework for solving problems using a computer. For example, I am not a programmer, but my basic programming knowledge allows me to use Excel and RPA and AI and all these various tools in much more powerful ways than I otherwise would be able to use them. Lastly, I do want to touch on AI tools. You know, of course, this stuff is new and it's going to be crucial to understand. I think everyone on this call probably already appreciates this. But, you know, ultimately, pretty much every single AI tool out there, you know, it disclaims that it's prone to errors and needs some level of human review. So in order for that review to be effective, you know, the human does need to have expertise or knowledge about what they're reviewing. So, for example, I did this AI class with the Maryland CPA Association, and they had us use ChatGPT to analyze data. This Excel workbook that had, you know, just hundreds of sheets of financial information. And the exercise was to try to get it to answer a question about, I think it was profitability for the Mott company we were working with. Now, it's very easy to get ChatGPT to provide an answer, but whether that answer is correct is another level of analysis. So we had actually no way of knowing the answer if ChatGPT gave was correct about this financial information without solving it outside of the ChatGPT tool itself. And it turns out not a single person was able to use ChatGPT alone to answer this question correctly. People who got this question right found out the answer outside and did their own Excel analysis and then kind of had to prompt GPT multiple times until it did get the correct answer. So I think that kind of speaks volumes to what these AI tools can actually do and how you can rely on them. You know, as for keeping my own team up to date, you know, I try to be careful not to overwhelm them because there is, you know, so much technology and stuff to learn out there. But, you know, whenever they're solving a problem, I always have them screen share. And if I see them doing something in Excel, which I know can be done better, you know, I'm going to say, you know, hey, try this Excel formula or, you know, kind of try to do it this way. You know, I also do periodic trainings with my team where I like show them, oh, this is what I did with my RPA bot. And I always offer them, you know, one-on-one trainings that they want to. So that's how I keep my team up to date.
Awesome. Thank you. I think that is a great summary of everything. And again, like I mentioned before, AI is only the start, not your end result. So, you know, keeping, you know, you have to use your best judgment and making sure that you can back up, you know, the things that the AI tools are giving you. So thank you for that. So I think You know, we're coming close to the end, so I think we're going to open it up to questions. So it looks like we have a couple that have been submitted. One being would, oh, and there's another polling question, I think. So would Sage Intacct replace QuickBooks or work to complement QuickBooks? I think that's for you, Heather, and John.
I can take that one. So yeah, definitely Sage Intacct is a replacement or an upgrade for QuickBooks. Yeah, so you'd move off. Yep.
And it looks like they want us to talk a little bit more about purchasing automation. Do you have any experience with that, Carl?
Purchasing automation, I'm assuming you're talking about like AP automation. So I could talk more on this, but I also think it's important to understand when to use RPA and AI and not to use, and AP automation is one of those. I'm adamant that you need to have a great third-party system like a bill.com. We use Tipalti. There's things like Concur. I recommend you look into one of those kind of formal third-party systems that kind of talk directly to your ERP.
Okay. And it looks like there's another one here that Christian brought up. There was a program that you developed to test federal grant compliance for the suspension and debarment requirement. I know you touched on it briefly.
Yeah. It's funny Christian brings that up because he was the audit partner at his previous firm who was auditing us. And one of the issues that they brought up was, you know, recently the grants department had been transferred to accounting. And, you know, it turns out that, you know, they were not the best at doing the vendor suspension and debarment search. So what you have to do if you have federal grants, you got to verify the vendors that you do business with, you know, aren't barred from getting money from the federal government. So normally that what that means is you got to log into SAM.gov and kind of search your name. 99% of the time, there's no results returned, but 1% of the time, there may be something that kind of matches that pops up. But basically, you got to do this. You got to document it because your auditors will be asking for it when they test, do your uniform guidance audit. You know, if you have thousands of vendors like we do, it's a very, very time consuming process. So this is something I immediately knew I needed to automate. So SAM.gov kind of has a API, which is kind of like an interface that a bot or a program can interact with. So what I do is basically our entire vendor list, it's verified using a bot against that SAM.gov interface. And every week we get an email report of all of our new vendors, and 99% of the time, again, none of them have any results returned. That file is a nice piece of documentation that we can give to our auditors. If there is something that, you know, pops up, maybe someone's named John Smith, I'm sure there's like 10 John Smiths that are debarred. We just go in and verify, okay, that's not our John Smith. Okay, and that's fine. But again, that's just neatly filed and documented so we can provide that for our auditors.
Nice. Very good to know. I had no idea that there was an API for that. All right. Well, we have come to a conclusion. So thank you all for attending today's Nonprofit State of the Union. We will be following up with the slide deck and a link to the webinar for you to take a look at later. And thank you all for joining.
Thanks, Alejandra. I just wanted to remind everyone to complete the survey that will appear automatically following the session if you would like CPE credit. Thanks again and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the GRF on the Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.